You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. With 2021 right around the corner, are you hoping to get back to the workplace? What might the office look like? Coming up, we'll look at how COVID-19 has affected the way we work and how it might change again in the new year. Now, issues of racial justice involve all people, white and people of color. That means considering the systems that have benefited white people for generations and how and why we should change them. Our guests are two authors, both white, who consider different aspects of reconciling the past. One explores what it's like to acknowledge white supremacists in the family tree. The other explains how racism pervades some modern American Christian teaching. Edward Ball has written 6 books, including topics like families and race. His most recent is called Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. And Robert P. Jones founded and leads the Public Religion Research Institute. He wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. I spoke with them as part of this year's virtual Wisconsin Book Festival. Here's part of our conversation from October. Robert, we're 21 pages into your book when you call Christian teaching racist. Some people might think, yep, absolutely. And there are other people who are going to read your book and maybe get a little bit defensive about that. Why do you use the word racist to describe Christianity?
Yeah, well, you know, the word racist, I mean, and right there in the title of the book is the word white supremacy, right? Another word that I think many people recoil, from. And I think there is a kind of defensive reaction, I think, particularly from white Christians that might say, wait a minute, that's not me, that has nothing to do with me. And when they think of that, they think of, yeah, people in white robes and sheets and burning crosses and then distance themselves from that. But, you know, I think one of the things that I try to kind of write about in the book as honestly as I can is how close to us today assumptions that we think weren't there really were. And this basic assumption that whites were a superior race to non-white people in the world and in the country was an uncontroversial claim through most of the country's history and through most of Christianity's history. And undergirding that claim in the country was Christianity as the dominant religious and moral force in the country and in the dominant expression of religion. So the strongest way to legitimize a worldview is to connect it to a divine ordering of the universe. And that's exactly the role that Christianity played through most of American history, was to kind of take what was really an uncontroversial view among most whites, that whites were a superior race, and to wrap that in kind of a Christian theological cloak and connect it really to the way that God created the world.
You say Christian teachings include the idea that white people are by nature different, by nature above people of color. How did people of Christian faith reconcile that? How do people do it now?
Yeah, well, you know, it's remarkable how recently this was just explicit. I mean, I think to our modern ear today, for many people, it sounds very odd to even say that. But, you know, in my home state of Mississippi, so I grew up as a Southern Baptist in Jackson, Mississippi, for the most part. And then my family is 6 generations back from middle Georgia in and around Macon, Georgia. But, you know, even as late as 1960, for example, Ross Barnett was running for governor of Mississippi, and he would on the stump give a Christian defense of segregation. And he would literally say, as a regular part of his stump speech, God was the original segregationist. All right, that was a line right out of his stump speech. And when he was elected governor, the tallest steeple church in the state, First Baptist Church of Jackson, Mississippi, held a special consecration service for him after he had run on this explicitly racist segregationist platform and put a Christian blessing on him as he went into office. So it wasn't that far back there that it's there today. What I show in the book is that it's not just historical, but even in public opinion data today, you can look at the views of white Christians and they look significantly different. That is, they hold more racist attitudes than whites who are not Christian. It's a real dividing line in the culture today. So you could still see this legacy creeping its way forward into the present. It's not just way back there.
Let's talk about that, because Edward, to one of the points you make in your book, It's very clear that this is not something of the past. There are elements of it that we've let go of, but white supremacy and these ideas are very much alive today.
Well, I think they are. I think that white supremacy has been a founding thesis of our national life. I describe it as an underground river that runs through the course of American history. It waters the roots of our institutions. White supremacy feeds the aquifers of our culture, and it remains underground, but occasionally it erupts in geysers of violence, in massacres, in widespread assaults on people of color. And then it returns, the geysers subside, and it returns to the underground of our cultural life. And what I do in this book, Life of a Klansman, is try to tell an origin story for white supremacy, how it inhabits, how it comes to inhabit the minds and mentality and routines of a single family, and how it becomes part of the atmosphere that's breathed in and out by a small group of people who become involved with the Ku Klux Klan. That's the smaller version of the bigger story that Robert is telling.
Your book centers around this direct ancestor of yours who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And you write, my predecessor, and you write, our Klansmen. Why do you go so far as to choose those first-person possessives? You take ownership.
Well, yes, I think it's important to try to take ownership of, you know, one's familial inheritance, good and bad. Most people who do family history prefer to take ownership of things in their ancestral past that flatter them. For example, to study the lives of people who were rich or people who were prominent in their communities. But if you think about it, quite a lot of us have ancestors who were involved in criminal activity, and in this case, in Klan activity. I have an ancestor, his name was Constant Lecorne, in Louisiana, in New Orleans, my grandmother's grandfather in New Orleans, who was a participant in the first generation of the Ku Klux during the years after the Civil War. And everybody in our family knows this, has known it for generations. But I wanted to look at it more carefully and try to tell the story of this one man as a way of understanding the mechanisms of white supremacy in a family context.
Edward, early in your book, you have this incredible description of a dinner table. And you describe it, it's cherry wood with a scalloped pedestal. The feet are like claws. And you write this, in a manner of speaking, we ate with our Klansmen 1,000 times. What do you mean?
Well, it has to do with taking ownership, as you characterized it a moment ago. This Klansman was a carpenter, and among his possessions, apparently, was a dinner set that came down to the hands of my mother, and was the dinner table at which our family ate 1,000 times. People in one's family life who might have been involved in white supremacist activity are not that far distant.
Robbie, how important is this idea of learning, of knowing not just in general, but really specifically about our own families?
You know, I think it's vitally important. And it's really about telling a truer story, right, about who we are and by virtue of that, how we got to where we are. I mean, I think we look around today, and if you ask, you know, gosh, why all the racial tension? Why all the strife around, you know, issues of race and racial justice? Well, there's a fairly simple story for that, but it's one that we don't know very well. I think that particularly for whites and white Christians have kind of suppressed, you know, this history. And I had a very similar, you know, experience kind of looking through my own family's, you know, archival stuff. I have inherited my mother's family Bible from 1815. And, you know, it tells the story of Pleasant Moon. He was a British, you know, immigrant to first to Virginia, then down to Georgia. And if I tell my own family story, just real quick, there'd be one way I could tell it is Pleasant Moon was a foot soldier in the Revolutionary War, right? It's a very patriotic way of telling the story. He came and homesteaded in Georgia on a 200-acre farm, staked out a claim. And, you know, that's the story that I kind of knew. But there's another way to tell this story. That is, Pleasant Moon won a land lottery to get 200 free acres of land in Georgia. Where did that land come from? It came from the Cherokee Indians, Native Americans, who had been forcibly cleared off that land by the federal government. And then it was carved into nice, neat little squares of 200 acres to give away to white settlers. And even for him, who was a not wealthy, basically kind of, we would call him like lower working class, a little bit more than subsistence farmer, he owned four enslaved people, right? He enslaved four people to even make his little subsistence farm work. And when I looked at the wills and the estate settlement, all of his worldly possessions when he died in 1818, 70% of those assets were tied up in four enslaved people, right? That's how much invested in enslaving other human beings. And this is the same family tree that has Baptist ministers. And so all of this is like very much compatible with what it meant to be a good, upstanding Christian. There was like, you know, no tension really there.
That's author Robbie Jones talking with fellow author Edward Ball. I spoke with them both during this year's virtual Wisconsin Book Festival in October. We listen to more of this conversation about white supremacy here on the Ideas Network in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. Now we continue a conversation about white supremacy in family histories and in Christianity. I spoke with two authors about the past and today at this year's Wisconsin Book Festival. Here's the second part of our conversation. You both tell stories, most of them, maybe all of them, rooted in the South. And we really need to talk about the idea that racism, white supremacy, this is not a Southern issue. This is an American issue. This is a human issue. Robbie, how do we begin to think about that? How do you pitch something when your book has deep Southern roots to people here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, I would say that what you said is exactly right. I mean, this is an American problem. You know, and while my book has a kind of memoir, you know, anchor to it, I do kind of broaden the lens a bit. And it's important to note that this too, that like that every Protestant denomination of any size split over the issue of slavery in the Civil War, right? So the Methodist split, the Presbyterian split, the Episcopalian split, it's not just sort of Baptists in the Deep South, but they kind of split into Northern and Southern Southern factions. And it's also to note that there is, you know, plenty of evidence that this is also not just a Protestant issue, that even in Catholic churches in New York, for example, as late as the 1940s, we're requiring African-Americans to sit in the back, only receive Eucharist after white members, you know, had received the Eucharist, had segregated the Catholic schools so that if you were an African-American, you couldn't go to necessarily go to the parish school that was most close to you. You had to go to St. Mark's. That was the Catholic school that you had to go to. So, and I think the bigger evidence for this is, and when I looked at current public opinion data and look at a whole range of attitudes, what we see is that this connection between Christianity and holding racist attitudes isn't only strong among white evangelicals, which are a more Southern expression, but you're in Wisconsin, right? One of the larger expressions there are mainline Protestants, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, United Church of Christ, like those groups. But they score in the book I developed what I call a racism index, and scales were 1 to 10, with 10 holding the most racist attitudes across a range of 15 different questions, 1 holding least. White evangelicals score 8, but white mainline Protestants, that group that's more populous than the Midwest, score 7 out of 10 on that racism index. And white Catholics score 7 as well. So they kind of cluster up there, holding more racist views. And even when I control for region, urban versus rural, those kinds of things, this relationship still holds up. So it's not just driven by Southern culture. It's not just driven by urban or versus rural. Or the connection is between being Christian and holding more racist attitudes, because that relationship isn't there among whites who are not Christian.
What do you, Edward, think about this being more widespread than some of the stories that you tell that happened in the South?
Well, I have a pet theory that the South taught the rest of the country how to behave with respect to race. Most of the African Americans in the United States have an ancestral root in the Deep South. Once African Americans left the Deep South and began to inhabit the northern cities and the West, and the white South had perfected the system of segregation and the psychological life of alienation between whites and blacks. And it was as though we conveyed or educated or tutored the rest of the country how to act with respect to African Americans. It would be a self-deception to say that the great people of Wisconsin or Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota are unaware or colorblind and do not think or make decisions on the basis of race. Quite a lot of us as parents spend a lot of time thinking about where our children are going to go to school. Quite a lot of us as homeowners spend a lot of energy thinking about where we're going to buy a house. And quite a lot of us are working in relationships in our workplace with African Americans, but have no Black friends and see no Black people in our lives until 9 a.m. on Monday morning. So it's a kind of realism that I would like to encourage, which is a sort of self-assessment among white people about where we are psychologically in relationship to African Americans.
To kind of add maybe just a religious layer on the top of this, there's a similar, I think, way I talk about this in the book is that, you know, so I talk about my, you know, upbringing in the Southern Baptist Convention, this slaveholding convention built specifically to legitimate clergy, in particular, owning slaves. But it's notable that denomination doesn't stay some fringe denomination once it breaks off. But by the 1950s, in the middle of the 20th century, it becomes the dominant expression of Christianity, bar none. It's the largest Protestant denomination of any kind by the middle of the 1950s and the 1960s. And so in the same way, I think Edward's talking about it kind of diffusing throughout the culture. I think that Southern Baptists really did that within religion. They diffused this way of being religious and this kind of views of white supremacy that then get spread, right, I think, into other areas. And the other just quick layer I'd add, too, is that when we ask a lot about how do we think about schools, how do we think about where we live, you know, the other question we can ask is well, how do we think about where churches got built, you know, and for whom? And so, like, if every white church, for example, ask an honest question about why is our church where it is, you're very quickly going to get to some issue of race and racial discrimination, real estate redlining, white flight to the suburbs. Those issues are going to come forward very, very quickly.
Robbie, you tell the story of your great-grandfather who died in a mining accident, and a Black man was blamed for his death. You remind us that the mine was dangerous, and then you write, I can only assume that both he and his family wondered as he left for work each day whether a misstep with his white coworkers or the wrong encounter on the road might be more perilous than the mine. And I mean, I have to say, I'm privileged. I do not feel this way. Black women, Black men, Black families, they talk about this feeling today in this moment that Black people are not safe when they leave their homes. They're not safe even in their own homes. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's right. And I think part of wrapping our heads around, you know, wanting to have a country where that's not true, right? Wanting to have a country where Black parents and white parents don't have to have different talks with their children. But having that burden of having to think about, you know, a society that's structured to put you at risk in a way that it is not structured to put people who look like me or Edward at risk, right? I mean, I think this is the goal, right? And but we have to realize that if we're ever going to make a headway on deconstructing and building that society, we have to realize that we built it. I think we've got an opportunity here to really deconstruct this in a way that we perhaps have not had in front of us, certainly in my lifetime.
We've only scratched the surface of the ideas and the evidence that you provide in these books. Robbie, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely to be here.
And Edward, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Kaylee.
That was my conversation with Edward Ball and Robert P. Jones. Robbie wrote the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And Edward is the author of Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. I spoke with them as part of the virtual Wisconsin Book Festival in October. Coming up here on Central Time, we're taking a look at what 2021 has in store for work. And you're part of the conversation. How has your work changed over the last year? And what do you think happens next? What do you need from your employer in 2021? Maybe you're a business owner. Tell us what you're wrestling with as you plan your company's future. You can call now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up this year, our lives were a little different. So was 1A across America. From the Rio Grande Valley to the suburbs of Michigan, history was made in real time, and 1A was there. We've got highlights from covering an unprecedented year in America today on 1A Plus. That's at 6 o'clock. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry. This story was recorded last year before the pandemic.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering.
Is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Scotty favorite brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas, who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
Lovely. If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, you can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What'll you have, lad?
Oh, whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Thanks for joining us here on Central Time. For many of us, COVID-19 has drastically changed the way work looks and feels. A new survey from MRA, the management company, says about 90% of employers are offering remote work to at least some of their employees. That's up from 33% last year. And if you do have to head into the office or the store, we've got new protocols to follow. Cleaning, dealing with shared spaces, how many people can be in one area at one time. So as the virus runs its course and vaccination begins, 2021 could be another big year for change in the workplace. We're talking about it now, and we want to know how you feel about work in the new year. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Are you looking forward to returning to an office, or do you hope to keep working from home? Maybe you haven't been able to work from home. How has work changed for you, and do you see that staying the same well into 2021? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234, or you can also tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. Jim Morgan is the Vice President of Business Development and Workforce Strategies with MRA, the Management Association. They're a nonprofit employer association based in Waukesha that serves more than 4,000 employers in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
We are rapidly approaching the end of 2020. How would you say employers are generally sitting today, considering everything that COVID-19 has thrown at them?
Well, I'd say by now, I think everyone has at least figured out how to cope with it. They've put their strategies in place and they've got the policies that they need. And now it's a hope game, I think, at this point, with the vaccine coming, with people, for the most part, understanding distancing and masks, that people have begun to understand what this takes. And now I'm just hoping to get out of it.
Yeah. How many employers do you think had plans for something so significant and unexpected, like a prolonged pandemic?
Not too many. We had a lot of companies that had disaster recovery plans around tornadoes or weather events or computers going down. But when you ask them about having a pandemic plan, in the audiences that I've spoken before and had a chance to talk to, it's usually, you know, maybe 5 to 10% of the people actually had a plan in place for something like this.
Are employers coming up with a plan then for the future, or are we still really in crisis mode?
No, I think we're out of crisis mode. I think one of the things that companies have done is they've been basically building the plane as they were flying it for the last 9 months, is keeping track of all of the steps that they took so that when this is over, they in essence have a real life pandemic plan because they've been through it now. They kept good notes. They looked at the policies that they had to change, and now we'll have something in place that, you know, heaven forbid, if this happens again, they'll be ready to go.
We're talking about what work looks like now and what it will look like into 2021. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Jeff in Superior on the line. Hey, Jeff.
Well, thank you. I wanted to communicate that in the electrical industry, it's an essential industry. So I've been working every day just like normal, full time. And this industry is hiring. There are jobs. We're looking for building trades, carpenters, plumbers, electricians. There are jobs in Wisconsin. I cover all of northern Wisconsin doing wholesale electrical distribution. And, you know, it's been a good year for our business in the sense that, you know, we've had storms and you got to fix up things after storms. But the electrical industry has a very promising future. It's a good industry to invest in.
Jeff, thanks so much for giving us a little bit of perspective into your industry. And Jim, I mean, Jeff's right. There are a lot of people who are part of essential industries. They cannot work from home. And that wouldn't help us if we did have someone like an electrician work from home. Are some businesses benefiting from the pandemic?
Yeah, there have been businesses that have grown and prospered quite well during this time. And, you know, for every industry that really took its lumps, like the hospitality industry, there are other industries that, you know, saw a need for their product. Maybe they made a cleaning supply, or they were in the manufacturing business and made ventilators or converted to making ventilators. This wasn't a lose situation for every employer. It was tough on all of us as individuals, but there are certainly companies that did very well during 2020. And some of them may be some of the companies that see a slowdown in 2021, while others will see normalcy return and their business will begin to grow. So there's no one size fits all in this. It's really hit different companies in different ways. And we are hiring in Wisconsin, and we've got a demographic problem here where we don't have enough bodies for all the jobs. So as we come out of this, we're going to be right back where we were again with a workforce shortage that we had going into the pandemic.
You say Wisconsin is hiring, and yet is it difficult for employers to hire and train new workers under these circumstances?
It's difficult, but the number of companies, there are some interesting stories now where companies they're finding the people online, they're interviewing the people online, they're onboarding them online, and the people are starting their job. And folks that may have been hired 9 months ago still haven't actually physically met the people that they're working with other than virtually. So it was one of hundreds of adaptations that people had to make that said, we still need people and we have to bring them on. So we're going to have to figure out a different way to do it. And they've learned some things from that as well. A lot of people have truly streamlined their hiring process because of the way they've had to do it now.
We're talking about the state of work in this pandemic and what it might look like as we move into 2021 with Jim Morgan. He's the Vice President of Business Development and Workforce Strategies with MRA. It's the Management Association. And you are part of this conversation. Call 800-642-1234. What's on your mind when it comes to work? Are you looking forward to returning to the office, or would you rather be working from home? Have you approached your employer about what you'd like to see as things let up and as it's safe to be close together again? And how concerned are you about your health and safety in your workplace? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Right now, we're talking about what work may look like in 2021 with Jim Morgan. He's the Vice President of Business Development and Workforce Strategies with MRA, the Management Association. They're a nonprofit employer association based in Waukesha. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Let us know how you're feeling about working from home or returning to the office or working in an essential service. What questions do you have about how work may go in the new year? 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim, I do want to talk about remote work. MRA's survey said that 17% of remote workers expect to be working from home through the middle of next year. What do you expect that transition back to the office will look like?
I think that's going to be one of the more difficult parts of all of this. Going through it has been very hard, but bringing people back, I think, is going to be difficult as well. Some folks are chomping at the bit to get back. A lot of us are extroverts and want to be around people and want to be back at the workplace. But there are other people who have found themselves to be very productive at home. And quite frankly, it simplifies their life a little bit while they're being productive. So companies now are going to, as they bring people back, if they had a culture of engagement at their office, of collaboration, cooperation, departments working together, you know, they built that type of family environment, I think people will be really excited to get back to it. If that didn't exist at the beginning and now someone has worked from home and found themselves to be, you know, as I said, very productive and they like the way that the work is going, I think then it's going to be an interesting conversation for employers and employees to say, all right, you know, we want to keep these people, they're talented, but we have a feeling that we need people together on occasion. And I think there's going to be some interesting conversations around that as we try to bring people back to the office again. And on the flip side, some companies have decided we're going to stay remote. We're going to have a lot of people be remote. It reduces their footprint in terms of office space. They found that people work better this way. Their employees are happier. So each situation is going to be a little bit different, I think, for every employer and every employee.
I saw this conversation early on in the pandemic where people were talking about how, you know, if your employer told you working remotely or working from home for some of the time during the week was just not okay or was impossible earlier, think about the fact that now you're working from home and what that means. I mean, has this pushed employers to a place where they're going to be either better able to or kind of forced to respond to more of the demands of employees who don't want to be in the office all the time?
Oh, I think it will for sure. We've got some demographics going on right now that we have more jobs than people in a lot of places. And so that means the employee is in a little bit better bargaining position perhaps than they were before. But there were also a lot of companies that had been looking at remote, thinking about going remote, weren't quite sure they had the technology for it, or were their leaders prepared to lead remotely? And all of a sudden they had to do it overnight. And so they've now got at least a 9-month experiment where they have had people at home, they've seen how it functions, and they're in a much better or least more educated position to decide, did this work for us or did it not? If we remained productive, if we could reduce office-based costs and people were still getting their job done, you know, maybe this is the route to go. And this was just a forced experiment, if you will. And now they've got a chance to look at the data that they've got for 9 months and make a decision on that.
Jim Morgan is the Vice President of Business Development and Workforce Strategies with MRA, the Management Association. We're talking about how the way we work has dramatically changed, especially as we end 2020 and as we look to the new year, trying to figure out what that might look like and answering your questions. We've got Sherry from Wausau ready to talk with us. Hey, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
So I work with people who have disabilities and I help them find jobs in the community. And it's a pretty large population of what I call the hidden workforce. So my question is, what kinds of efforts are being made to kind of reach out to them, especially in the 2021 job market, to kind of help them engage in work and fill those jobs that are open there?
Sherry, thank you for helping us understand your work and for calling with that question. Jim, what about people with disabilities? How are employers going to make sure they're included in the prospective job applicants?
That's a really good point by Sherry. And we have been encouraging our members and companies in our four-state area for years now as they're trying to fill that talent supply chain to look to people with disabilities as an opportunity to expand it. I think historically people had maybe hired a person or two with a disability. It was almost more of an altruistic effort than an actual productivity and company advancement effort. And as we learn more and more about different things, people with disabilities also have great abilities and they're doing incredible things in different companies. And so we're trying to provide our member companies with examples of, here are organizations that have hired people with disabilities. This is how they've worked. These are the types of things that they can do, and really just help them understand it's just another employee in your facility. There may be additional support that's needed, but that support exists, and you've got an opportunity to tap into a whole nother talent pool as you're trying to find people to fill the jobs you've got. And so right now, I think you've got employers looking at a variety of different places that maybe they didn't look before. And opportunities like this, like people with disabilities, is one of the places that they're going.
There's another aspect to how work has changed. There's research that shows that people, including women, LGBTQ plus employees, and people of color are having the hardest time balancing work and home life and all of the demands there. How can employers better serve those folks?
That's another really good question as to how employers are going at this. Again, because we've got a talent shortage, it's really driving people to be innovative. And so I think where you just used to be, you put an ad in the paper and you took people in and you interviewed them and that's who you got. Those days are long over. And companies now are trying to target different groups and say, what is it that we can offer for this group of people? Maybe it's stay-at-home moms or dads, or it's people of color that folks didn't approach before and say, how can we make our workplace a more welcoming place to make it, to be an employer of choice for different groups where they feel comfortable working? Because again, these are very talented people. They may have had bad experiences in other places for a whole host of reasons. But if I right now I'm trying to hire 100 people, I'm trying to make sure that I'm going everywhere I possibly can to find every individual that I can. And so now you've got companies that are maybe changing their shifts. They're looking for people in different places. They're using other employees to recruit for them because they've got to figure out different ways to find where the talent is. And regardless of whether you're a person of color, a person with a disability, maybe someone we didn't look at before, now we've got to be a little bit more aggressive. We've got to be a little bit more thoughtful in the way that we go about trying to hire people. So I think you're going to see, again, that innovation where maybe where companies had a blind eye on some things, they now are opening their eyes up. And those who have been doing this for quite some time are the ones that are successfully working their way through this more difficult time because they put that in place a long time ago.
Jim, how big of a game changer are vaccines?
I think it's huge. This is going to be a mind game. All the way through this, we kept coming up with all these different strategies. But the reality is, until people feel comfortable, they know that their employer is doing things to keep them safe. They know what the cleaning is that's going on, the masks, the distancing. And now you add the vaccine to that. That will completely change the game that I think people now, as they begin to feel comfortable with the vaccine, as the numbers of people who get it continue to grow, that's going to gradually begin to reduce some of the fear of even whether it's going to work or the grocery store or being in a crowd or just being with 10 other people. It's a mindset now that we've got to get everybody comfortable. We've got to see the numbers go down. And I think the vaccine will certainly help the numbers go down and people will begin to see normal lights at the end of the tunnel, hopefully very soon.
And we'll stop right there on that little blip of hope. Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. And if anyone needs anything on the information I've shared, they can get it at mranet.org.
We'll make sure there's a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time, too. Jim, thanks again. Jim Morgan is the Vice President of Business Development and Workforce Strategies with the Waukesha-based MRA, the Management Association. Talk to him about how the pandemic is affecting work now and what it could look like next year. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow, we explore what happened at Camp Randall in the mid-1800s. 1,200 Confederate soldiers were held as prisoners of war at the former Union training camp in Madison, Wisconsin. We've got the author of a new book who explains how the conditions were poor and death rates were high. That's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, news from NPR and WPR. Then the COVID-19 pandemic could have an outsized effect